Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Julie Ellenbecker, president of Ellenbecker Investment Group. EIG believes in the importance of education, allowing people to gain the knowledge to feel confident in their personal decisions. This show highlights the unique financial perspectives of its many guests, including economists, attorneys, book authors, business owners, and tax professionals. It is provided for general information purposes only and does not consider your particular investment objectives or financial situation and is not intended as recommendations appropriate for you. Before acting on information on this show, strongly consider seeking advice from your own financial advisor. The opinions expressed on Money Sense do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Ellenbecker Investment Group employees and leaders. Please enjoy today's show.
Money Sense is brought to you by Ellenbecker Investment Group, four-time recipient of the Better Business Bureau Torch Award for business ethics and integrity. Ellenbecker Investment Group is the only Wisconsin investment company to receive this prestigious award more than once by providing exceptional planning and extraordinary service each and every day. Go to ellenbecker.com and listen to Money Sense Saturdays at 2 and Sundays at noon.
Wealth advisor for Ellenbecker Investment Group. Ellenbecker Investment Group is located in Pewaukee, just north of I-94, between 164 and Highway F, in Ridgeview Corporate Park, and in the village of Whitefish Bay in the Equitable Bank building across from Winkies. We also service clients in Bonita Springs, Florida. Visit ellenbecker.com for more details. My guest today is Dick Schiller. Welcome back, Dick.
Hey, Jamie. Thanks again for having me.
Dick has been a friend of EIG and working with us in a strategic manner for many years. He and his father-in-law, Terry Pavlik, help us with strategy in terms of putting together our fixed income, core fixed income, bond, strategies. We're going to talk about that today. Dick has been on the show many times, and we're very glad to have you back today.
Awesome. Looking forward to it.
Great. So here we are. It's the last couple days of February. We thought, for today we were going to talk a little bit about kind of how we ended up 2024. And then we had, a pretty solid month in January. Obviously, there's just so many things going on right now with, different things you see in the news. Obviously, we had an election in November. I think everybody's paying close attention to that.
That's right.
Yeah, remember that? And then, I guess where I'd like to start off with our first few minutes together is just kind of getting an update on the economy and interest rates and kind of how you think our economy is doing right now overall.
Yeah, definitely. So, I think going back over the last couple of years, the number one topic has definitely been inflation. Remember the word transitory? And was it transitory? I don't know. If you look back, it definitely is jumpy. I think it took a long time to get back to where it is today. Back in the middle of 2022, we were at 9.1% on the headline CPI number. So that's a broad inflation gauge. And that's come down. We've made a lot of progress, right? In the summer of 2023, we were in the threes. We have been bouncing around in the low to mid threes throughout most of 2024. We ended in September with a low at 2.5. But the problem is since then, 2.5 in September 2024, we've steadily bounced back up. Mm-hmm. 2.6, 2.7, 2.9, and the latest one in January was 3.0. So most people recognize the Fed's target on PCE, a similar inflation metric, so a little bit different than CPI, but the Fed's target is to get to 2.0% annual inflation year over year. So, we've made a lot of progress from the 9% print we had in 2022, but we're not quite over the goal line yet. And if anything, the past couple months, really why I think the markets have stalled here to come really relatively flat from a stock perspective is the last 4 months have been upward moving CPI prints, again, from about 2.5 to 3.0. So that I would say if you have one metric to watch over the coming months, that's the number one metric. As inflation, if it goes higher, the Fed is more on hold. They have less motivation to cut interest rates. And that historically has meant slower economic growth and a more tightening of monetary conditions. So we'll see. We're in a little bit of no man's land, definitely above target. You know, it's been almost 18 months now where the inflation print has been around 3%, and that's good, but not good enough, right? And I think the other key thing that people need to keep in mind that often remind us is even though inflation has come down to 3%, it's not a negative number, right? We had massive bouts of inflation mm-hmm. in 2022, 2023, and people are like, you know, people are saying, oh, inflation's gotten a lot better, but, you know, I don't see the prices coming down. And that makes sense because it's not that the prices have declined, it's that the rate of growth of increase has slowed. So instead of going up and to the right, it's maybe a little flat line, but up and to the right. So, you know, I think it's a little bit, people yeah. sometimes say, watch out for, you know, I want prices to come down. So, you know, we really want deflation. And on the one hand, you know, I get it, that makes sense. A lot of prices are elevated, but also in a deflationary environment, it can be pretty nasty just for stock prices in general. So, you know, I've heard a lot about the price of eggs year to date, right? I think yeah. that's, you know, over $5. I joke, my wife likes to buy the eggs that are have a weekly massage therapy and are brown and cage-free. And I'm like, I see these going yeah. over $10, right? And at right. what point are they going to be double-digit for a dozen eggs?
Yeah.
When I was growing up, we would have the styrofoam, you know, great value white eggs.
Eggs were eggs, right?
The eggs were eggs.
So today, much different, obviously, so many different factors into that.
For sure.
And what with that whole egg thing, the inflation we're seeing around that, that's really not particularly stemmed by anything that we're seeing.
Yeah, it's bird flu.
It's bird, yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, it's there, obviously, there's factors, but it is really something to see that hit the pocketbook that way for sure.
It's incredibly jumpy if you just look at the price of eggs. And the price of eggs are a component of the grocery component of food and dining, mm-hmm, which is sure. a component of CPI. And that's one of the things we talked about in our advisor conference a few weeks ago was yep. really what goes into that 3%, right? And yes, eggs is 50%, but up year over year, but that's, you know, 0.5% of the 3% calculation. So it's a small factor. And it makes sense, is eggs is probably 0.5% of the sure. average person's budget.
Well, let's touch on that for a moment, because, you know, inflation is measured by several different components, and you mentioned that food is part of it. What are some areas of the economy where we're still seeing increased inflation? I think the top of it is rents and housing. And
yes.
then, you know, so if you maybe let's talk about the top few, and then we'll work our way down in ones where maybe they're not as inflationary.
Yeah, great question. And I love digging into the numbers because I'm a data junkie, and this is right up my alley. So as of the latest inflation print in January, the big ones are auto insurance, which that's been a continual problem over the past couple of years for a number of reasons. I think cars are getting much more sophisticated, and they're becoming computers, and they're not just, you know, fix the brakes, fix the, you know, if you get in an accident, all of a sudden you have 7 parking sensors on your front bumper that need to be replaced, recalibrated,
right.
And because of those reasons, along with some others, right, we're seeing consistent increases there. Airfare is still higher, you know, fuel is higher, and wages also of pilots, flight attendants are higher, so we saw 7%. And then, you know, you mentioned rent, and rent is a historically lagging indicator. It's a little bit frustrating how they calculate it. The owner's equivalent rent tends to, you know, right now the last reading was 3.9%. It tends to run on a 6 to 9 month lag. If you looked at, you know, the apartment REITs, for example, and how much they're pushing rent, they had this 20% boost during COVID, and then it's been relatively flat since then. So, you know, 0 to 1% versus what's being incorporated into the CPI numbers, 3.9%. So that's what that 3.9 is really bringing up, that overall CPI number, because shelter makes up about 1/3 of the contribution of the entire CPI print.
Interesting. Wow.
And house prices are higher, right? You see mortgage rates are higher, although, you know, that's not technically in the calculation of owner's equivalent rent. You know, you have that dual factor, property taxes up. I don't see many things of I got a discount on my property tax bill. I've never heard that in the past couple of years.
That doesn't happen too often, does it?
Insurance isn't going down. Prices aren't going down. And mortgage rates, yeah, we ticked over 7, but those are still, you know, just shortly off the high.
And I saw one interesting aspect of that. The cost of education is actually lower, I think. Am I on point with that?
Yeah. You know, I think from a tuition basis, these universities have push as far as they can. It reminds me a little bit of seeing like PepsiCo and Coca-Cola earnings, right? And they've pushed price really, really as fast as they can, or they're finally starting to see some pushback from the consumer to where, you know what, I might get the store brand chips instead of the substitutes. People are starting to trade down, especially on the lower end of the income spectrum. And the same thing goes with education, like you mentioned. Like someone might say, you know what, and we do this as part of financial planning, we'll put in the school. And a couple of weeks ago, I put in Northwestern University. I was curious what it costs. And the number the software spit out was $90,000 for tuition, room and board, books, fees, $90,000 a year for 4 years. And oh, by the way, the child isn't going there and for another 15 years. So we really need to plan for $150 a year for 4 years.
Yep.
So it's really gotten pretty crazy expensive.
Really has. So, well, no, that's very good. Thank you, Dick, for sharing that information. I mean, it's very important to kind of keep these things in perspective because, you know, I remember when my parents bought their first house and, well, I don't remember it exactly, but I was very young in the 70s and they paid like $25,000 for their first house.
Wow.
Interest rates at the time were, you know, near 18%. And then, you know, that house today is probably a median, you know, home in a nice neighborhood. And
right.
It's probably gone up 800%,
mm-hmm.
you know? So very fascinating. So before we jump to our next break, or our first break, I should say, what would you gauge our economy today? Do you feel like we're in a pretty strong, solid economy, or are you seeing some things that might be concerning?
Yeah, you know, the last year, if you put inflation, the number two debate was soft landing versus hard landing. And I think a lot of the economic metrics still out there today, especially on the services side, and lesser so on the manufacturing side, all still do point to soft landing. I'd say there are some things, you know, a bit of slower retail sales, for example. Unemployment, you know, it's not as low as what it was at 3.5. It's at 4.0 right now, but that, you know, did come back. It ticked back down from like 4.2 down to 4.0. So, you know, the burden of proof still rests with the bulls. We're still in a bull market, but there are some subtle signs of cracks from the economic data. And sometimes that doesn't mean we're going to have a fall in stock prices. There are differences between the price of stocks and mm-hmm. the economy, but they're definitely related. So it's something definitely we need to watch as we head into 2025.
That's great perspective. With that, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Sense. This is Jamie Williams, Wealth Advisor with Ellenbecker Investment Group. And today we're with Dick Schiller, Chartered Financial Analyst with Pavlik Investment Advisors, a friend of EIG and also an expert in fixed income and the markets. So before the break, we were talking about the state of the economy. We touched on, you know, interest rates and how things were kind of funneling through from a standpoint of inflation. As we move here into the second quarter, hard to believe it's March of 2025. Dick, I wanted to get your thoughts on some of the aspects or, you know, elements of tariffs. They've been talked about, obviously, with this current administration. It's not the first time the U.S. has been involved with tariffs. In fact, I mean, we've had tariffs in previous administrations where they haven't even been really discussed as much as you're seeing it today. We talked about headlines a little bit. There's a lot going on. Would you like to share with us how your view is on how tariffs kind of work and what the potential impact might be?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I'll admit I don't have the answers, but I'll also say that I don't think anyone else out there does because of how early on we are in seeing how all of this sorts out. I think the, you know, the tariffs against particularly Mexico and Canada were, you know, going to be levied at 25%. And I think we're right in the middle of a 30-day grace period after they made some concessions around strengthening the border. So, you know, they haven't been implemented yet. Hard to say exactly how it's going to be worked around. I just had a call this morning with a guy who installs chips. So from NVIDIA, Intel, AMD, really interesting perspectives. And, you know, a lot of those chips are coming in from outside of the U.S. And it's not something where we can just, you know, flip a switch and say, okay, we're going to start manufacturing those here in the U.S. It takes years to build the facilities to be able to create some of these chips that go into everything from our cell phones to our computers to the equipment we're speaking into right now to our cars. So I when I take a step back and try really to stay politically agnostic about it, it's hard for me to envision a scenario where tariffs are deflationary. So, you know, thinking, will this really bring the costs of goods down? You know, my thought is probably not. The worst case scenario is that, you know, that inflation number that we were talking about in the last segment goes from 3.0 to 3.5 or even higher to 4.0. If it does move in that direction, you know, the Fed is definitely not cutting anymore. You know, so they'll stay in that Fed funds rate in the low fours. And if anything, we could be talking about potential increases again. And if that were to be the case, I think that would be the most obvious reason to see some volatility in both the stock and the bond markets, coming up later on in the year.
So I think one thing I heard many years ago from a colleague who was also an analyst, and he would always say, economies are complex adaptive systems. And that, you know, I just think that probably textbook, right? But when things like this do come online, and if they are imposed, you know, hopefully there is things in our, you know, trade and elasticity of the economy that will help us smooth things out. So I think that poses a question, I think, for many folks. Is the Fed going to react to things, or is it all eyes on Fed right now in terms of how they have to maneuver to keep interest rates in the right range, because the outlook of interest rates has changed, I think, in the last couple of months, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, for sure. You know, the Fed will say we're staying out of politics and we're watching the economic data that continues to roll in. And yes, I get it. That's true. What they'll fall short of saying is that we're wondering how tariffs and some of the other implications around government spending cuts. Let's just, you know, throw that out there too, right? Mm-hmm. You know, what are going to be the implications of some of the cuts from DOGE? You know, is let's say the Department of Defense, right? It cuts there. What does that have an implication for some of the economic data out there? And that matters, right? They're not going to say, "Hey, we're watching this," but they're watching it, I think, like everyone else is. And where they're at in a position right now, the market, we entered the year expecting two rate cuts, two 0.25%, 25 basis point rate cuts. So somewhere, you know, in the mid fours to just above the high threes to low fours is where they set their range at. And after that latest inflation print in January at 3.0%, the markets pulled back. You could tell they were hesitant. They said, we're wait-and-see approach. Yep. You heard that wait-and-see quite a bit, and now the market expects just one rate cut sometime in the summer to late fall. So we'll see. You know, data-dependent are their favorite two words. And what I take that is they're watching what's going on in the political world, too, and seeing how it translates into that economic data.
No, and I think that's a really important thing to consider when we work with constructing portfolios and we're trying to find the right allocation for our clients to meet their individual investment objectives. We want to make sure that we are expecting some level of volatility to happen in terms of markets and pullback. And that brings up a question around, you know, how we saw in 2022 the correlation between stocks and bonds was very similar. And in terms of where we're at today, we ended up 2024 with a very positive year. The S&P was up 23%. Another good year following 2023 where the S&P was up near 25, I think, or more. Mm-hmm. And then year to date, we had a positive January. February here is looking like, you know, we're going to be pretty much flat to maybe break even for the year. But in terms of the correlation between stocks and bonds right now, are you seeing any disparity between that?
Yeah, it's really interesting. If you go back to the last couple times we've had economic disruption and stock price pullbacks as a result. So really 2002, 2003 in the tech bubble, 2008 great financial crisis, and even to, you know, some of the BRICS issues in 2012, 2013, and COVID, you know, throw COVID in there too. So, you know, and then we'll pull out the inflation turmoil of 2022 in the equity markets. Four of those five pullbacks, of the last five pullbacks in stocks and bonds have had a negative correlation, meaning stocks mm-hmm. have gone down, bond prices have gone up. 2022, that pullback was the lone exception and really driven by inflation. So if inflation continues to march higher, interest rates are they're going to have a floor under them, right? The mm-hmm. Fed isn't going to be cutting. So that Fed funds rate, the shortest end of the yield curve will stay at 4. And then depending on where growth is, the further out rates along the curve have upward pressure too. So if that scenario happens, you know, I don't see mortgage rates falling from 7, you know, much, much lower than maybe 6 or 5. But, you know, another thing to keep in mind is that if growth really slows, that tends to push interest rates down. And that's why in four of those last five pullbacks, we had this negative correlation, because growth slows, interest rates fell, and we, you know, stock market prices of bonds moved higher, stock prices moved lower. So, you know, we'll see. I think that, you know, like you mentioned, stocks have had an incredible run, you know, last 3 years, trailing return are close to 45%, whereas, you know, the U.S. aggregate bond index is closer to flat, right? Just looking at the index out there, not really speaking to our portfolio specifically. But, you know, at some point, there I do believe in some mean reversion, that it's more common, more healthy to have negative relationship between stocks and bonds. And, mm-hmm. and we should see that again going forward.
Very good. We've been meeting with Dick Schiller, Chartered Financial Analyst, on discussion around a lot of different things here today. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back after this break. Thank you. Welcome back to Money Sense. This is Jamie Williams. I'm here with Dick Schiller. We are talking a little bit about the economy, lots of different concepts here relating to tariffs and, you know, we just, before the break, we're talking about the S&P 500 and performance of the S&P with the idea that at some point we're going to see some pullbacks. And, you know, it's pretty normal. I think this year to date, there's been at least 3 or 4 all-time record highs in the S&P. We've had a little bit of a pullback this past week in the S&P. But in terms of volatility, I was just kind of looking back on an average. We see usually 3 to 4, 5% pullbacks in a given year, and more often a 10 plus at least once a year, which would be, you know, going into kind of a correction territory. And we really haven't seen that in the last year plus.
Yeah, two years. Really going back, you know, that 45% growth in the trailing 2 years has really been, you know, call it 20 to 25 in 23 and 24.
So that's where I like to incorporate in our discussion with clients. You know, everyone's got their own unique situation happening with, you know, their cash flow needs and things relative to what their goals are in their planning. But kind of tying it back to your strategy, Dick, in terms of, you know, putting together a bond ladder. Do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, the income protection aspect of what we're trying to do with these bonds and how that can work really well?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, like you said, right, we've seen really great performance on the stock side of the equation. So if you just look at, you know, the S&P 500 index, it's not a perfect index, right? It seems to be the best one out there because the performance is the best, but that does ebb and flow with what is viewed as the best performance there. But, you know, you're on the heels of 2 years of 23-24% returns on both of those segments. So, you know, likely from a balance perspective, your stocks have outperformed your bonds. And on the one hand, you know, they're two different asset classes, so we can't really compare them. They have different return and risk characteristics. But what we're really looking for on the bond section of your portfolio is stable, steady income protection. So, you know, and how I think about it is stocks over the long run definitely should be 8-10% growth. When you include dividends, you can get on the higher side, right? That 10-11%. That comes with, you know, it's not 10% a year. It's up 20, it's down 30, it's up 25, it's down 7. We just so happen to be in the past 2 years up 23, up 23. And I think one of the things that I want to make sure people realize is that it's not going to be up 23 for every year for right. The next 2, 3, 5 years, right? We're quite frankly, we're overdue for a pullback. A healthy market normally sees a 10% pullback once every year, and we haven't seen one since 2022 when we had those large inflation prints we were talking about in the first section. So the purpose of the bond portfolio is, in my view, to lower the overall volatility of the entire portfolio. So we want to be generating income. The benefit of higher interest rates means that the bonds that we've been purchasing over the past couple years, we generally trying to stay close to par value, meaning $100 per bond. The coupon interest that we're earning is around 5%, right? And our going in yields to maturity for new money of the bond portfolio is about 5.5%, meaning on average, we're buying at a slight discount to par. So say buy a bond, $97, $98, know that's going to be at $100 at maturity and collect 5-5.5% coupon throughout the course of the hold. You know, that's pretty nice, steady income above the rate of inflation, right? Inflation is 3.0% right now. And has it lagged stocks? Yes, for sure. But I think at some point, we're going to see market volatility again, and there will definitely be a point where bonds will actually be outperforming stocks. And when that time comes, you know, we're going to be encouraging you to say, hey, take that bond maturity and maybe buy stocks, right? But we haven't been saying that a lot in the last year to 2 years because of this magnificent run that stocks have enjoyed over the last 2 years.
That's great. And I know that it provides us with a lot of flexibility and opportunity because as we are continuing to work with clients, Ellen Becker's been here, you know, now for, you know, going on 3 decades. Many of our clients that started working with us in their 30s and 40s are now retiring. And as I'm sitting down with many people planning, I love the idea of having a projected maturity when it comes to one of these bonds coming due within the year. It might not be all of their income need, but when we're in a good, sound, solid stock market performing as it has in the last couple of years, you know, we're spending from stocks and rebalancing from stock funds. But in years like 2022, when, you know, markets were down, rather than liquidating, you know, a fund that had, I don't know, 1,000 different bond CUSIPs in it, we're able to have an anticipated maturity. So we really like that a lot. One of our kind of core strategies for our clients, especially as they approach retirement, is that income downside protection, income protection piece that I like to, you know, reference, and to have 5 to 7 years of your income protected, just so that if we do find ourselves in a really difficult market environment, we don't want people to feel like they can't spend, like they can't take that trip, like they can't still have those family events and things that they love to do or buy a car. That's the big one today, right? Because the last time I checked, a car is, you know, like $30,000 or $40,000 ticket these days. So
that's the used car too.
For used cars, yeah. So You know, I think that's really important. I really appreciate you sharing that. Now, one thing I did want to kind of differentiate on the bonds are, do we kind of lean toward a specific type of bond? Are they, you know, I know muni bonds have been talked about. Those have some tax benefits, but there may be a reason why we don't maybe focus on those.
Yeah, so we have screening parameters set up across each maturity or going out 1 through 10 years. So if we need to maybe plug a hole in a bond ladder, or if simply a bond matured in 2025 and we're adding to 2035, we're rolling the maturity down the ladder, we'll use that screen for the 2035 year. And if you just blindly say, hey, I want an investment grade rating from both S&P and Moody's, there are four or five other parameters that we put in place too. What will float to the top are all Pacific Gas and Electric and Edison International. And if anyone knows what those are the two utility companies that are based in LA. And although they have investment grade ratings, the big risk is that they could be found responsible for the wildfires in LA. So it's a great example of, you know, and that might be the highest yielding investment grade product that's available out there today. But we're shying away from that because we don't know what is the cause for the forest fires to begin in LA. Mm-hmm. And maybe the findings will come out and they'll be truthful. Maybe they won't be truthful. Maybe they'll find these companies responsible. Maybe they won't, right? It's hard to say. To us, that sounds like risk, right? And we're trying to shy away from risk while maintaining that balance between earning yield. You know, one client asked, well, why don't you just go and buy Microsoft bonds? Microsoft bonds, you know, there's very little risk, great company, you know, A-rated securities. And what's interesting about that is a lot of the rates that Microsoft bonds are trading at are below that of the U.S. Treasury. So the market feels that the likelihood Microsoft is a stronger credit position than the U.S. government, which can open up a whole nother discussion topic around deficit and back to tariffs. But that's the balance where, you know, we don't own a lot of Microsoft bonds simply because, you know, we're finding other opportunities where we can have higher yield but still keep risk to a minimal point as possible, right? Our goal in bonds is to get paid back principal value as well as the interest payment.
Now, that's really interesting because, you know, you mentioned Microsoft, right? They're one of the Mag 7. And I was doing a little bit of research before the show today, and I just happened to notice that speaking to the income protection and the maybe some projection around increased volatility around some sectors, including information technology, the chip manufacturing, you know, a lot of that has really fueled a lot of the growth in the S&P the last 2 years. Many people may not know this, but if the first seven stocks in the S&P were up 111% for 2024, they were up 60% for 2023. And the rest of the market, stock 8 through 500 in the S&P, radically underperformed relative to those, but they were still doing very well. So very interesting to think about what that could mean for volatility as we move ahead in terms of a possible pullback. You know, everything is kind of all eyes on earnings and guidance, and we've seen that already happen a little bit here. So I think we just want to make sure through that income protection, we don't really have to worry. We can let stocks do their thing and work through these cycles. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this message. Welcome back to Money Sense. We've been talking with Dick Schiller, CFA at Pavlik Investment Advisors, friend of Ellen Becker for several years now. And before the break, we were talking about, you know, a lot of things. One in particular was kind of planning by having an income protection approach using high quality investment grade bonds to kind of match maturities of cash flows. And then we kind of touched on some of the aspects of the market being, you know, definitely performing very high. Some of those tech companies that have really produced a lot of earnings for the S&P, and the volatility aspect of things, right? We haven't really seen a tremendous amount of volatility in the last 2 years, but at some point we know it's going to be here and we want to be prepared for that. And if it doesn't, great. I mean, we're just going to move ahead with our plan and our strategy. So, Dick, I was just, you know, I want to tie in some tax ideas here for people. And then from a standpoint of planning in general, what are some things that you might think that investors should be planning for now in terms of, you know, what they can control?
Yeah, certainly. So when I first sat down here with Jamie, I was joking that maybe we should have had this tomorrow, because when we're recording this, NVIDIA is reporting after the bell closes, so after the market closes today, and it definitely is going to be the most watched or report as it has been for the last five or six periods. So that will drive volatility in the markets, and I don't doubt that they're going to put together a great report. What the market is always looking for is, you know, what is forward guidance. They expect to continue doubling revenue and earnings. You know, like you mentioned, Jimmy, they're driving a ton of the EPS growth of the S&P 500. So we'll see. We'll see what tomorrow brings. But, you know, I think the thing that I always go back to is, I don't know how NVIDIA is going to report. No one really does. I don't know how the market's going to react to it. What I do know is that regardless if it's good or bad, I personally, and I encourage my clients not to make any drastic changes to their asset allocation policies, right? And so my, you know, barometer, my like kind of line in the sand is like, hey, if, you know, you can't sleep at night, if, you know, you're watching your stock prices move up and down and it's drastic for you, times are good right now, right? So how are you going to feel when we have that 20 or 30% correction? Probably a lot worse than how you feel now, right? Because again, times are, this is good, right? And so how
we're in a euphoric place, right? I mean, exactly. We're kind of in that, hey, everybody wants to get on board. And, you know, I think like you mentioned, NVIDIA went from less than $1 trillion valuation to now over $3 trillion in the last 2 years.
Surpassing Apple, right? They're neck and neck.
Yep. Not to say that they're not going to continue. I mean, we just don't know. We don't have that crystal ball.
What we can control is one, our spending, right? I think that dovetails down into your financial planning question is, how much money is going out at the household level is a really good number to start with. And then, you know, add on the other side, how much money is coming in? Is there Social Security? Are there maybe annuity payments or pension income we see a lot of? Trying to build up really that income and expense. So build up a personal P&L. If someone's in retirement, they may have excess, they may have shortfalls. If it's a shortfall, you know, the funding plug is funding it from your investment portfolio. And so, you know, all these numbers, all this math we're doing has nothing to do with how the market is performing. It has to do with you, your advisor, sitting down, setting a plan. And then from there, it really boils down to, okay, you know, personally, let's say you have a portfolio and you can live off the dividends of 100% stock portfolio. Great, awesome. You know, you're in a very strong financial position, but maybe you don't like seeing your money go up and down with the stock market as much as you do, even though financially you can afford to have that type of risk tolerance. There's a psychological impact of this business where, you know, even though financially you can be in there, that asset allocation, we want to pare that back a little bit just to help you sleep at night.
Yeah, no, and I really agree with you on that wholeheartedly. And we have tools. There's all kinds of things from, you know, people talk about the 4% rule with the kind of the back of the napkin calculation and what that means, all the way to very complicated software that we can pull up. And, you know, we talked about college planning earlier, right? We can model those things in. But I think one of the themes for planning that a lot of people miss, and I'm running into it with a lot of people I know that aren't clients, but, you know, I'm recommending that they look at taxes.
For sure.
And tax planning. We're in the middle of tax season right now. Everybody's getting their 1099s and W-2s and, you know, there is a lot of control people can take over making sure that they get that right. And I believe, you know, and this is part of the reason why EIG started a tax division 7 years ago, was so that we could take some of the the guesswork out of that for our clients and help them understand and build kind of a pathway to success. And so we're in the middle of it right now. But I do encourage people to really sit down. If they have someone that they work with, don't just, you know, take the returns, sign them, and then just wait until next year and do it all over. Maybe understand the numbers a little bit, try to sit down and try to build a plan around how you're saving. And the one biggest miss I find with people is probably not putting money in Roth accounts. There is something you could get people started very early on. There is something called a custodial Roth IRA. And even kids that are in high school that have a part-time summer job, if they have W-2 earnings, earned income, 1099 income, can contribute to a Roth IRA and get started. So that's just one idea. There's so many others that that come with that. And a lot of, on the other side, when people are retired and they have IRAs, when they achieve age 70 and a half, if they're doing any kind of charitable giving, there's a strategy called a qualified charitable distribution where people can gift from their IRA and then not have to be paying tax on those dollars that are distributed. So a lot of firms now are even allowing, you know, people to write checks for that reason or for that purpose on their IRAs, which many of our clients have been, you know, kind of coached to understand how that works so that we can properly do it. So those are just a couple additional ideas. We don't know how exactly the TCJA Act of that was passed, the Trump-era tax cuts from 2017, are going to, you know, kind of end up looking like. But we do know that for this year, 2025, things are not expected to change. So, you know, look at that. Try to take advantage of the lower tax environment we're in now. Be strategic. Work with your advisor, you know, or reach out and connect with someone here at EIG. If you're looking for a plan, we're happy to help you try to start to sort out some of these things. So with that, Dick, you know, we've got a couple minutes left here today. Just thought I would see if you had anything else you wanted to add or any words of wisdom for the road ahead.
No, I think everything you mentioned makes a ton of sense. And I'd say the biggest misconception about just our industry in general is that, well, you hire a financial advisor to time the market, to tell me when to get in, when to get out, what to buy, when to buy it. And, you know, I really think of that as maybe 3, 4, maybe number 5 on the list of why you hire a financial advisor. I think of the value that, you know, we've added historically over time has been the number one, I would say, has been preventing someone from doing something that really hurts them in times of duress. So mm-hmm. talking them off yep. the ledge when times get tough. We haven't seen that tough environment in several years. Some people say 2022 was a recession. Some people don't. Obviously, COVID was a recession, but very short-lived. Not many people had a V-shaped recovery on their alphabet list. I remember L, W, U back then.
Right, Nike swoosh.
Nike swoosh, but it was truly a V. So
it was a V.
You know, we haven't had that type of volatility in a while, but we'll have it again, right? And I think the number one way that advisors do add value is to keep people to stay the course. Number two is a lot of the tax planning that you mentioned. Yep. You know, and I think what makes advisors really good, and we can only do so much with what our clients tell us that they have in play too, right? So part of this is use us. That's what we're here for. Don't be shy. You know, I know both Ellen Becker, Pavlik, we send out a lot of emails. Just reply, say, hey, yeah, my son or daughter does have earned income, and maybe let's look into opening up a custodial IRA.
Can be a great gift too.
A great gift, and, yep. and setting a good example, right? It may not be the highest dollar amount, but then, you know, that child can see, wow, okay, I saved for this, and I'm not going to touch it for 50 years until I retire. And if you'll get some trailing 50-year yeah. returns, they're pretty impressive numbers.
Time value of money,
that's
right?
That's right.
Those who understand it win, and the others that don't lose.
They pay it, yeah. That Albert Einstein quote.
Albert, yeah, in short summary. But, well, thank you, Dick. That was really great, insightful conversation. We always appreciate you coming on the show. I'm going to just kind of close by saying that Money Sense airs on Saturdays from 2 to 3 and on Sundays from noon to 1. If you enjoyed today's show and want to learn more about EIG and our upcoming events, please visit ellenbecker.com or give us a call, 262-691-3200. As always, I hope that we've made a difference in your personal and financial well-being. Remember, before we plan, before we advise, before we invest, we always listen. Have a great day. Thank you.